So whatever your hormonal or health challenge may be, the answers are waiting for you at What Women Must Know. Where leading authors and holistic practitioners, researchers, and wise elders will give you the keys to getting your hormones back on track naturally. Be sure to listen every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM. And if you didn't catch it live, you can listen 24/7 on the archive. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia, Solotopia, Solotopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we multiplied, we needed more. The rich got rich, so the fuel ran scarce, the price jumped high, and so they gave nuclear power a try. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
But the nuclear plants were built in haste, with too many risks and no place for waste. And so from Seabrook to Shoreham Town, we have to shut those new plants down. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Now we're fighting wars over oil. No matter who wins, it will not last. The earth is scarred, the planet is warming. Don't you think that all of it's a great big warning?
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve?
Friends for the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We got a great, great show for you today with David Swanson. We're going to talk about war, peace, Fukushima, and all the stuff we need to talk about to have a planet that's going to continue to live and get to Solartopia. David Swanson, are you with us?
Hey, Harvey. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks. Good, good. Good to hear Pete Seeger and the Rivertown Kids with Dar Williams and David Burns singing the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness song. And that's from the Rivertown Kids' Tomorrow's Children album, which actually won a Grammy. David, it's an honor to have you here. David Swanson is one of the great activists of our time. He's been on the show before, but we've moved to a new time today. We're on Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern time from now on. Thanks to the crew in New York for getting us on at this slot. It's much appreciated. David, I was moved to have you back because of an absolutely brilliant piece you wrote about the coming of World War One, which is a great bugaboo of mine. I wrote a book called Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States about World War One, which really decimated this country and from which we never really recovered. And I wonder if you'd be game to do a live reading on that. You wrote a paragraph-long sentence about the coming of World War One, and I mentioned it to you before. I wonder if you'd be game to read it to our listeners. I just was totally moved by it. David, you are such a great campaigner against war in general. One of your books is War is a Crime, and, of course, your RootsAction.org website has carried petitions against Fukushima and so many other things. Have you got that in front of you? Can you read me that sentence?
I do. I just found it. You, like 99% of the people in the world, got that almost right. I have a website called War is a Crime and a book called War is a Lie, which I did just to confuse everybody. The story I got from the British media that the Secretary of Education for the United Kingdom was outraged that one of these comedy shows, I don't find them terribly funny myself, but British humor on TV, was making fun of World War One, was, you know, having soldiers depict World War One as comical and ludicrous and involving senseless total slaughter of masses of human beings. I guess the sentence you're looking for is my response when the Secretary of Education in Great Britain objected that people were referring to World War One as a misbegotten shambles, a series of catastrophic mistakes perpetrated by an out-of-touch elite. And I replied, well, what would you call it when a group of inbred cousins meet to squabble over petty matters of competing egos at all the best weddings and funerals and then return to ruling over their respective nations as divinely appointed monarchs and ministers eager to send their peoples off to murder each other for no particular reason? Especially if these sociopaths and their sycophants each decide they must offensively attack the other first, not because war can begin so quickly, but because it takes months to badger people into knocking off the wisecracks, abandoning all sense of human decency, and picking up a gun, and then to put those people on trains and send them on a trip to a big field in which imbeciles on horses with swords will try to conquer machine guns and poison gas, eventually realize how ridiculous they are being, and hide in tents far from the fighting while ordering millions of others who have no interest in the affair to kill each other year after year after year for no earthly reason and with nothing to show for it at the end. An end predetermined by mutual agreement, but with the fighting continuing until that appointed day and hour.
Well, there you go. That's a beautiful statement on World War One and on war in general. World War One, of course, ended a period of peace and prosperity in 1914 in Europe that had begun with the end of the Franco-Prussian War in 1871. And, you know, there was a phrase used when Gore was running to succeed Bill Clinton against George W. Bush. What is it about peace and prosperity you don't really like? I've read a lot of the literature from the period leading up to World War One, and it would appear that the bourgeoisie, the middle class in Europe and France and in Great Britain, in Germany in particular, seemed to have gotten bored with peace and prosperity and thought that they, for some reason, needed a war to, jazz up the gene pool. I mean, what exactly was going on in the minds of the people of Europe that would lead us into World War One, and by connection, in our time, to lead us into this ridiculous, worthless war that we fought in Vietnam, and now the one in Central America, and now the ones in Iraq and Afghanistan. What is it about the mentality of a rich country that convinces it somehow that war would be a good thing?
Well, I think there was a widespread belief that war could be a good thing around the time of World War I and for a period of time prior to World War I that we haven't seen nearly as much since. I think World War I was a turning point in that regard. People like Teddy Roosevelt, who used to talk about the need to go to war, that it's good for the race, it's good for the people, it, you know, builds character and so forth, you don't hear that anymore. Nowadays, wars are sold as the last resort, as necessary to defend us from some looming enemy, or to bestow our philanthropic goodness on some nation in need of being built or saved by us. You know, in quotation marks, of course, they don't get built or saved. I think that at the time of World War I, you didn't necessarily have that belief among the people. There was no opinion poll taken. These were not democracies in any true sense of the word, or even in pretense in many regards. I mean, this was a royal elite deciding on having a war, and a lot of it was rivalries and affronts and offenses among the leaders of these nations, and fear that the other might decide to fight first, combined with this sense that sooner or later there's going to be a war. So let's be the ones to start it. Since it's going to take us a month to put people on trains and get them ready to go start fighting, and it, you know, Germany in particular wanted to go fight on one front really fast and turn around and go fight on the other with the same soldiers. And to do that, you have to start first. And of course, France doesn't want to be the one to start second. So you end up with this mad rush to war, somewhat like you're seeing in the United States Senate today. Well, there is just this incredible opposition to the possibility of peace with Iran, you know, which the people of the United States have no objection to peace with Iran. But if you are in the United States Senate and you're from the old Confederacy, which has been giving us war after war, or you're from New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and you're working for AIPAC, not for your constituents, you're ready to do everything you can to get a war going with Iran, even though culturally, you know, most of us have moved beyond this idea that a war could ever be a good thing.
Well, let's talk about that now, because this is very current and very important. You know, you and I have studied World War I in great detail. Many have not. I do want to recommend Adam Hochschild's book about World War I that was quite brilliant, actually. And it really did destroy the United States in many, many ways. Woodrow Wilson, my least favorite president, along with Andrew Jackson, used World War I as a pretext to wipe out the ideological left in the United States, to suppress the Socialist Party, to lock up Eugene V. Debs, the great socialist leader, and to prompt the Red Scare and all the other horrible things that were used to decimate the Bill of Rights and the Constitution in the United States. Now I don't know if we can legitimately say we're out of the war in Iraq. It doesn't seem really that way. We're waging a ridiculous war in Afghanistan. That a new book now from one of the insiders, Robert Gates, says that Obama is really half-hearted about. Why he's at all hearted about it in any way, shape, or form is a mystery to me. And we have a bunch of people, Democrats, by God, up there jumping and screaming that they want essentially a war with Iran, which only has, 70, 80 million people, very advanced technology. This whole idea that we would march in there ubiquitously, omnipotently, and have our way is insane. So David Swanson, tell us what your take is on what's happening with this move to a war in Iraq now, Iran, rather.
Well, thank you for that and for pointing out what Woodrow Wilson was, a local boy from not far from me here in Virginia, who really was the Barack Obama of his day on steroids in terms of liberals' fantasies about what he was saying as compared to what he was doing. I think that with Iraq, we've gone full circle. We've gone from, we meaning the U.S. government, has gone from arming a horrible government in Iraq to sanctions, to wars, to invasion and occupation, back to arming a horrible government in Iraq, a government that is attacking the people of Fallujah as if they haven't had enough help already from the United States. I mean, the devastation of that town and the lasting birth defects and cancers, and now Hellfire missiles being shipped out at Hellfire speed over to the people, over to the government of Iraq to use to attack Fallujah some more, with the pretense that it's been taken over by Al-Qaeda. You know, this is a disaster that keeps going. The U.S. military is out of Iraq, and things did not get worse. Things got better as a result, but these are relative terms. The country's been destroyed. It's in chaos and will remain so without a massive program of actual assistance as opposed to so-called military aid. Afghanistan, of course, the current president tripled the U.S. presence there. It is still to this day greater than it was when he moved into the White House, and he's been given credit for ending that war for some 5 years, while the abuses and atrocities continue, and the lawless imprisonment and torture and the rest of the package continue. And we're going to pile on top of that Iran, which, you know, if you loved the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, you are going to go nuts for this one, because it is going to be far bigger, far worse, far more dangerous in terms of the possibility of blowing up into a catastrophic regional or global inferno. And you have the same people. People have been lining up the quotes of what Bill Kristol said about Iraq and what he says now about Iran, what Lindsey Graham said about Iraq, what he says now about Iran. And it's the same stuff, the same lies from the same people. And I think part of that has to do with the lack of information about what was done to Iraq. The majority of Americans think Iraq benefited, think Iraqis are grateful. You know, while the majority of Iraqis say they're even worse off now than they were before, shock and awe. So, you know, this level of ignorance and misinformation that is in small part contributed to by the peace movement, because the peace movement wants to focus on the harm to U.S. veterans, thinking that that's the way to bring people into the peace movement. You can't expect people to care about Iraqis. Well, it helps leave the country in ignorance about the fact that 99% of the deaths were Iraqi, that this was a one-sided slaughter of women and children and men and grandparents, like all of these wars are, that it was not a contest on a battlefield, but a mass murder that destroyed a nation, and that, of course, they're not grateful for it. So I think that the silver lining in all of this madness is that the American people have turned against these wars, and are not about to give their popular support to another one, and that when we had the opportunity presented to us on a silver platter to say yes or no, we said no. We said no to missiles into Syria, and people run like mad from the realization that that was popular influence that did that, but that was the number one cause there. You know, it was a perfect storm. You had the Congress members home on vacation and people confronting them at town hall meetings. You had other governments taking action. You had the House of Commons in England saying no for the first time in centuries. You had the Congress moved to demand a vote and then able to make clear which way it would vote, but it was public opinion overwhelming the Congress with demands that not happen, that was primary in keeping it from happening, which means that we can do it again. And to their great credit, many organizations right now are mobilizing to say, no, we do not want this move for a war on Iran. Did I lose you? Hello. I'm talking on and on, but maybe to no one.
Hello.
Harvey. Hey,
yes.
Harvey.
Okay, so it seems like there's a ceaseless push by the people, the powers that be, the people on top, the U.S. government, the military, for one war after another. You know, if Iraq wasn't enough, they need Afghanistan. Afghanistan wasn't enough, they need Syria. Syria wasn't enough, they need Iran. After Iran, it'll be somebody else. And that, doesn't that seem to be the dynamic here that's working?
Well, it is. There are people who want war, and there is a consensus built into our culture now that there will be more wars. We have routine, casual conversations on television and in newspapers about how the next war will be fought. How will we be prepared for the coming wars? There's no question as to whether there will be wars or not. And this is a problem. And this is what you run up against when you talk about these issues, especially in this country. People are convinced that you can't get rid of war, that it's not an option, that war is inevitable, that somehow it's in our genes or it's in forces of history that can't be conquered, which is baseless nonsense. And then you run up against the notions from both sides of the bipartisan so-called divide that favor wars, not just so-called defensive wars where you go halfway around the world and attack an impoverished, unarmed nation in defense, but humanitarian wars where you fantasize that you've assisted the people of Iraq or Libya or Afghanistan. And this puts us in this, you know, ludicrous position of seeing libertarians oppose attacking Syria because it would cost money, and humanitarian warriors in favor of attacking Syria because we can't discriminate and Syrians are just as good as we are and they deserve to be bombed just as much as we do, even though, of course, nobody is advocating bombing ourselves. And so at some point we have to get out of this mindset that there can be a justification for a war. There cannot. I'm sorry?
David, what is it that keeps pushing? Is it economic? Is it psychological? Is it sociopathic? What is it that keeps pushing us towards the next war? What's this dynamic, and how do we get rid of it?
Well, part of it is the lack of representative government, the corruption of the system, which 85% of Americans in polls recognize correctly over and over again is broken. This system that we go off and kill people in order to bestow it on them, we do recognize that it's broken. We have Congress members bought and paid for. We have weapons manufactured in little bits and pieces across key congressional districts in order to be able to threaten to take those jobs away if those weapons aren't made, weapons that then, of course, must be tested and used and replaced if the profits are to continue. We have weapons companies giving money, bribing Congress members to get them elected. We call it campaign contributions. We have corporate media outlets that do not discuss the issues discussed on this radio program, that push for war, and more war, and do not question it, and seek to gain access to the war makers and the approval of the government, rather than the gratitude of viewers and readers who might appreciate investigative journalism. But beyond that, you know, it's not just that the government isn't listening to us. It's that much of the public has been persuaded by the government that you need wars. That you need wars for jobs. I mean, this is where you get into mass sociopathy. I mean, the idea that you're going to have a program of mass killing and justify it as creating jobs, even though it isn't true, right? Even though economists will tell you that you get more jobs and better paying jobs by putting the money anywhere else, even tax cuts for working people. So it's worse than nothing, as you might expect if you stop and think about what it is. It's funding destruction. It's not funding the creation of any useful product or capital in this country. So we have to explain to each other and stop and think and understand that war can be chosen. We can choose to have this war machine continue or not. And so I've been involved recently in starting up a what is going to be and is rapidly turning into a broad global coalition of individuals and groups working to end war, not in one shot, but understanding our work step by step as moving toward that end, and as part of it involving the educational process of making people aware that we can move toward that end. And the place to find out about this effort is worldbeyondwar.org.
Okay, that's worldbeyondwar.org. We're talking with David Swanson, one of the leading peacemakers in America, a great advocate for ending all war. And we really need to get to the core of this, David. This is a question that has devastated our economy, our social fabric. You, of course, are much younger. You may not remember the March 1966 when Lyndon Johnson made the horrible decision to escalate the war in Vietnam, and he could have pulled out. And I had what I can only describe as a hallucinogenic moment earlier this week. I was talking to my daughter, who's 14 years old, and she was telling me that the family of one of her classmates is headed for a scuba diving excursion, a family vacation, I can barely say this, off the coast of Vietnam.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? I mean, you know, I kind of left my body when I heard this. She said, Daddy, can we go to Vietnam and go scuba diving? I mean, God, didn't we lose that war? Didn't the communists take over? I mean, what happened here? If anybody, you know, if there's any lesson, any way for the public to learn the lesson that war is utterly ridiculous and useless, it's the, you know, case study of Vietnam. The Obama administration is now talking about supplying a nuclear power plant, for God's sakes, to the victorious communist government of Vietnam that we expended 58,000 lives and God knows how much treasure to prevent from taking power. You want to comment on that, David? Are you back in your body on this one?
You know, back in the time when the United States was killing people, you know, some 4 million people in Vietnam through various horrendous means, the United States was providing and supporting the use of nuclear energy in Iran. And when the government of Iran changed at the end of the 1970s and the United States government then desired its overthrow, well, then the presence of nuclear energy in Iran was, of course, the closest step to nuclear weaponry, and the pretense was created and maintained for 30 years. That Iran had a nuclear weapons program, which of course it never has. So, you know, you can only foresee the possibilities in Vietnam of where nuclear energy takes them in terms of U.S. foreign policy. Should their government not support U.S. aggression toward China or whatever it might be, it's you know, something that can be used as incredible propaganda, never mind the danger that nuclear energy is in and of itself, as Fukushima has so clearly demonstrated to people. But I was go ahead.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. I mean, I teach history and a number of other courses at two colleges here in Central Ohio, and I explain to everyone in my classes that the reason they have student debt, the reason we don't have national health care, the reason our environment's a mess and the economy is in decline rapidly in this country dates back to the war in Vietnam. I mean, you know, the Cold War was mighty expensive. The Korean War was crazy. But when we got to Vietnam, we stepped over the line. And it really took us down a downward spiral, economically, psychologically, psychopathologically, into a deep hole from which we've never really recovered. And now with Reagan, we have the ridiculous war in Central America. Bill Clinton essentially used nuclear weapons, depleted uranium in Yugoslavia, and another one of those humane wars, by the way. And now we're neck deep in Iraq, Afghanistan, and looking at Libya, of course, and looking for yet another country to invade. We are talking with David Swanson, War is a Lie, and so much else involved in his peacemaking efforts. He's incredibly articulate, writes beautifully. And when we come back, David, I want to you mentioned, well, I mentioned nuclear energy, and we both have been following the Fukushima story. You were kind enough to run at Roots Action a petition asking that the world take over at Fukushima. And we have also seen now that Fukushima has essentially been used as a pretext for destroying whatever democracy there is or has been or was in Japan, to the point that now people in Japan are talking about the civil liberties situation there in terms reminiscent of the days of the lead up to Pearl Harbor, for God's sakes. So let's take a short break, if you don't mind, David. We'll come back in about 3 minutes and talk more about abolishing war, and we'll get into a little more about Fukushima and nuclear energy. This is the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, and we'll be back in a few minutes. All right, we are back with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, talking to the great David Swanson, one of the world's leading peace activists, very articulate and energetic, almost omnipresent spokesperson for peace. We were segueing, we were talking about the insane idea that Barack Obama would be giving Vietnam a nuclear power plant, for God's sakes. And, you know, those kinds of things kind of make me want to leave my body or result in such a reaction. So at any rate, David, let's talk about Fukushima. You and I have done a lot about it. You put a petition I circulated up at Roots Action and got over 40,000 signatures within a short period of time. Very impressive, actually. I have a new petition out there now, but, and we'll talk about that. It's about sailors on the USS Reagan. But let's talk about what's happening in Japan with this new regime, the Shinzo Abe regime and the State Secrets Act. Tell us what you know about what's going on over there.
Well, it's a right-wing regime, and it's being encouraged in that direction, as far as we can tell, by the United States. I don't know what the new ambassador, Carolyn Kennedy, another name from the past, will do. But Japan, of course, has had, since World War II, a constitution that forbids it to create a military and make war. Of course, it's been occupied by the U.S. military with the great protest of people around the bases, which have been put in corners of Japan that have been had the least power to resist them, including Okinawa, where a decision has just been made to not get rid of a base that the people are incredibly opposed to. But the section of the Japanese Constitution, Article 9, that forbids war, is a terrific model that ought to be expanded to other countries, not taken away in Japan. And that, of course, is the move. And when you move toward war, you move toward secrecy and increased governmental power, just as we see in this country. We shout liberty and we wave flags and signs that say freedom, and we scream about how we're killing people for our freedoms, but of course we predictably lose our freedoms during the course of the wars. And this is what happens anywhere around the world. War is an excuse for government secrecy against an enemy. War is an excuse for abuses of civil liberties, not their expansion. And this is what we've seen since World War I and before. It's interesting, you know, that the U.S. military is now spending more money than it spent during Vietnam, despite the fact that it's not having to kill millions of Vietnamese. And it's spending millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, on a Vietnam commemoration project through which the Pentagon and other agencies are working to improve the image of the U.S. war on Vietnam, make it look better after all of these years, which tells you something about the importance that the government places on understanding of history. If they're going to have more wars, they have to have the past wars understood as better than they were experienced at the time. President Obama calls the Korean War a victory, and so forth. This is part of the process that we see our government go through.
Yeah, well, let's clarify about the Korean War. The Korean War was waged under UN auspices because it was pulled off by Harry Truman. The Russians were out of the Soviets were out of the Security Council, and Truman managed to sneak the Korean War in under the radar. There, we lost, as best we could know, about 55,000 Americans. The war started and ended in the same place, basically. There's an argument still today about who attacked first, the North Koreans or the South Koreans, but a war did start. It went on for upwards of 3 years. To the best of that, one can like a president, Dwight Eisenhower did become the only president in the 20th century to campaign on the promise of ending a war and then to actually end it. Now, he did go to Korea, as he promised in the campaign of 1952, and he did end the war in Korea. To call it a victory, come on, who won anything in the Korean War? The Chinese swooped down, the Americans swooped back up. General MacArthur wanted to attack China, stepped over a line, the Chinese swooped back down again, and then everything wound up right where it started, with a horrific mess the Korean War was, but at least it was only 3 years as opposed to Vietnam, which we can pretty much time from 1965 to 75. And now Afghanistan has gone on even longer with no apparent end in sight. What do we got? How many thousand troops do we have in Afghanistan right now, David?
Oh, I don't remember exactly, 40,000 maybe, but plus, of course, contractors and mercenaries that aren't counted in that count. Just as the dead Afghans aren't counted in the list of dead, and in Korea there were two or three, maybe more than 3 million people killed. So the 36,000 or whatever U.S. Service men and women, as we call them, as if they were doing someone a service, were the least of it. This has been the case since World War II. These wars are one-sided slaughters when it comes to the wealthy nations intervening in the poor ones.
Right, and now we have a situation, of course, where the American military is talking about going into Iran. Iran is a big country, 70 to 80 million people. It's not a particularly poor country. There's lots of poverty in Iran, but Iran is actually very powerful. You mentioned earlier that the West was conspiring to give nuclear plants to Iran. In fact, leading up to the 1979 fall of the Shah of Iran, the French and the Americans were on board to give the Shah 36 nuclear power plants. If you can imagine 36 nuclear reactors in Iran now, and what the war fever would be like, the overthrow of the Shah by the Ayatollah in 1979 ended, thankfully, the program of Americans and French trying to give these 36 reactors to Iran. Now the Americans are yelling and screaming that we have to go to war with Iran because allegedly they're building a nuclear bomb. It's insane. And, I think anybody who has any idea about going to a war with Iran is really talking about the end of the American economy. I mean, it would just be absolutely a slaughter. And I see absolutely no way that the Americans come out on top of that one.
Nobody comes out on top. Jeanette Rankin said you don't win a war any more than you win an earthquake. But here you could destroy the world. You could create a global war, a nuclear war. You're guaranteed to further drain this economy, further destroy and corrupt our government, further erode our civil liberties, further damage the natural environment, and further antagonize and create enemies out of people around particularly that region of the world. And if they imagine they can do it with a few bombs bombs and it's over with, without retaliation by Iran to U.S. troops in the region or to U.S. allied dictatorships and monarchies in the region, forget it. It's not going to happen. This is going to escalate, and they're going to be deeper and deeper in, which is why the time to stop it is now, when there are senators and Congress members trying their hardest to throw a monkey wrench into any possibility of diplomacy and negotiated agreements between the United States and Iran. I mean, this is you have the possibility of peace looming, and they're running for it, scared out of their wits. I mean, they're trying anything they can think of to avoid peace, which tells you where this is going to go if we leave it in the hands of our senators and Congress members.
Yeah. And I got to say, there's a parallel, and we're going to segue into this now, if you don't mind, David, into renewable energy. There's a parallel with renewable energy going on. The coal, what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, the fossil nuclear industry, is terrified of renewable energy at this point in time. It's a very strong parallel to the fear that peace strikes in the hearts, if they have them, of the military. So does renewable energy strike fear in the hearts of the nuclear power complex. Now, in Japan, we have this horrific thing going on at Fukushima. I continue to write about it at nukefree.org, and we all know that this is an apocalyptic event at Fukushima, and it has also destroyed Japanese democracy, or given whatever democracy Japan had, and given the current administration, the Shinzo Abe administration, an excuse to clamp down on the freedom of speech and press through the State Secrets Act. Anybody speaking out about Fukushima is looking at 5 to 10 years in prison now. And so we don't really know. We can't really find out what's going on at Fukushima. It's a terrifying situation. And as you mentioned, David Swanson, this administration in Japan is extremely militaristic. They have harkened back to the bad old days of Japan prior to World War II, leading up to Pearl Harbor. He has gone to a military shrine and, you know, is saber-rattling against China, for God's sakes. It's pretty scary, actually, and a lot of it does have to do, unfortunately, with nuclear power.
It's incredible that this is happening in this supposedly shrunken globalized world, and we're not being told about it. I mean, this week you have horrendous news out of Fukushima. You have the TPP, potentially the worst treaty and trade agreement ever created on Earth, pushed for fast track in Congress. No word about that. No big news stories about that. You have this drive for war with Iran moving into full gear, and all we're hearing about is, you know, the governor of New Jersey's petty vendettas, and the only place we're finding useful information is through the internet. And what happened today in a federal appeals court? But they ruled in favor of Verizon and against every single one of us and the internet. And if this ruling stands, they're going to turn the internet into cable television, and you're going to have to buy different levels of access, and the corporations are going to block access to stuff that they don't favor. So, you know, we are under assault on all fronts, and we don't have a choice of, am I going to be an environmentalist or a peace activist or a advocate for good governance? We got to do it all right now. It's, you know, it's all on the line, because if they take the internet away, where are we going to be able to communicate in the ways that we do now? I mean, we cannot let this one happen.
Yeah, it's really terrifying, and I'm sure other folks at PRN and around the blogosphere are talking with great fear about this horrific court decision now allowing the ending equal access to the internet, and creating a situation, as you say, where we wind up with cable television as opposed to the freedom of speech that we've been enjoying with the internet. We're talking about with David Swanson, rootsaction.org, War is a Crime, so many other great contributions. And what we have coming from Fukushima, there's a lot of radiation and not much information. We really don't know what's going on there. There was, you know, quite a bit of coverage prior to the State Secrets Act focused on the bring down of spent fuel rods from Unit 4, which is an absolutely terrifying prospect. Spent fuel rods hung in the air, 100 feet in the air at this exploded Unit 4 General Electric reactor on the Japanese coast. And, an accident at this thing could release horrific quantities of radiation. We can't get decent information. And then we see all these la-di-da pieces turning up in the corporate media about how no one is being harmed by the radiation from Fukushima, and that no one will be harmed. It's like these people are on some kind of quaalude or brain-altering chemical that has them telling us how good it's good radiation is for us. It's, I call it the Ann Coulter syndrome. Ann Coulter actually got on TV and said that small doses of radiation are actually good for you to make you stronger. And we keep reading this stuff, and there's no mainstream media attention, quite the opposite, to the case that's very clear that Fukushima is horrific. And as we know now, it's taken down whatever was left of Japanese democracy. The Japanese government absolutely does not want any adverse information spreading out about Fukushima. They got the Olympics coming, or so they think, in 2010. And it's only a matter of time before that spreads here, don't you think, David?
Well, craziness that doesn't offend Fox News owners and advertisers makes Ann Coulter money. Money is the brain-altering substance here above all others. CNN is in with nuclear energy in terms of its finances, and when it pushes propaganda like Pandora's propaganda or Pandora's promise, as they call it, the beauty and the glory and the goodness of nuclear energy, they aren't doing it just because they've arrived at that conclusion. If this was a fair and open debate, they wouldn't be censoring every useful piece of opposition to the nonsense that they're pushing. They have an agenda. They have a financial agenda, and it's something that we are going to have to deal with. And a big part of that, we've always thought in recent years, would be building the internet into something that could compete with the corporate televisions and newspapers and radios, building the internet and the good radio shows. That we're going to have to reexamine regardless, but we're really going to have to reexamine if they go after the internet.
Well, of course, they've been going after the internet. The challenge to the corporations, the last thing the corporations want is freedom of speech. The only thing that's keeping any kind of global democracy alive at all has been the internet and free access to the internet. And this court decision today is really the first major assault, success on the part of the corporations to clamp down on free access to the internet. The internet has been the only thing that's been saving any of us, as far as I can tell, since George W. Bush came into the White House. And they've been, attacking it full bore. And this, of course, the Supreme Court is never going to, at least the Gang of Four is never going to go for equal access to the internet. That's not going to fly, because that's the last thing they want to. I mean, it's a really serious situation.
Well, Congress, in theory, Congress could pass a law that mandates equal access to the internet. In theory, we could amend the Constitution and override all of the branches of government and do it ourselves. But the Supreme Court is given the powers it has by the Congress, which in large part couldn't care less. When they get flooded with our emails, and when we organize through the internet and tell each other what's happening in Fukushima or anywhere else, that they don't care to hear about, and then we go and tell them through every available medium and in person, they see a power that they would be just as well without. there are a few Congress members with some principles left, and there are some who can be shaken into having some principles when we organize and agitate. But certainly my life would be completely different if I had to do it offline. It would be interesting, but I think above all it would be frustrating and fatal to many movements that just do not have any sort of access to television or the New York Times or the Washington Post, which by the way is now owned by the guy who owns a majority share of and runs Amazon, Jeff Bezos, who has contracts with the CIA worth twice as much as what he paid for the Washington Post. So we are up against growing levels of corruption and yet growing levels of awareness among the people of the corruption, of the wrongness of our policies, environmental, energy, and foreign. And it remains to be seen which of these trends is going to win out.
Well, there's nothing been more vital to the free flow of information than to any kind of saving grace that we've had over the years than the free access to the internet, and this is really the ultimate issue here. We're not going to survive in any way, shape, or form with any kind of democracy with the clampdown of the internet. It's the only thing that's been keeping us going, and the internet has dwarfed in importance, thankfully, finally, these major networks, CNN, CBS, NBC, the Fox, I mean, the internet in my world, at least, is far more important than they are. And I think that the corporate establishment understands that. And this is their big attempt to clamp down. We're talking to David Swanson here, one of our great peace activists. I am very, very concerned, as you can tell, about what's happening in Japan with Fukushima. And as a source of radiation to the planet, we're hearing all sorts of stories now about the death of the Pacific Ocean, radiation coming to California. And, of course, the nuclear industry is countering by saying that there's no real danger, no health threats. I will point out that Barack Obama, in the midst of the Fukushima disaster, got on national television and said the radiation coming to the United States wouldn't come, actually, wouldn't harm anybody, but there has yet to be established a national radiation monitoring system. Finally, just at this late day, we're almost out of time, David. The canary in the coal mine appears to be these sailors who were aboard the USS Ronald Reagan, down to the last 2 minutes here, who were irradiated. Have you followed that case at all?
Only through you, and you are my source of information here, and it's an ironic group and an ironically named ship, and I'm very interested to see how it plays out.
Right. So, last words, real quick, David. Tell people where to go to see you, to see your website, while we still have access on the internet.
While you still can, go to places like rootsaction.org, where I work and take action on this question of internet openness and many others, and go to the new project that I'm working on, a work in progress, very much under development, but people and groups in Japan and everywhere else getting involved, and that is worldbeyondwar.org.
All right. It's great to have someone with your power and persistence focused on ending war as a whole. It's something we don't think about. It's one of those impossible dreams. There was a time, and you've written about it, where peace was in place after World War I, before World War II, Kellogg-Briand Treaty, and other steps were taken by the powers of the world to outlaw war. And how successful was that, David?
Well, World War II came, and World War II came because armament continued despite public sentiment and negotiations and treaties. The arms race continued, and Wall Street and other Western countries favored the fascists and the Nazis over the Soviets.
And we can read about it on your website, David Swanson.
Yes.
It's been great to be on with you. Let's stop this war in Iran. Let's save the internet. Let's bring on Solartopia. We got no choice. David, good to talk with you. Thank you all for listening to another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thanks to the crew in New York.
We will see you next week, once again, Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Take care. We're moving ahead, and we hope you're coming with us.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn.